I'm going to read to you some excerpts from a novel called The Whistling Zone. It was published 18 months ago. I began work on it about 6 years ago. I make that point to convince you that I didn't crib from the current headlines in preparing for this particular appearance today. It deals with some troubles in a very large university, the largest university in the world, the University of the State of Oklahoma, to whom has been sent by an Eastern foundation known as the Fund for Humanity, a young professor whose name is Christian Mother. He is a liberal, and he finds himself from the very beginning in considerable conflict with the reactionary political forces that are running the university. By way of orientation, a few of these names that crop up in the first line that I'm going to read to you. Buck Frick is a sort of a veteran type. He's the commander of a veterans organization, very strong in the community and represents, of course, public opinion. Leaping Lena Lubell is, his name is Leonard Lubell. Leaping Lena was his name when he was a great football hero in the same university some 30 years before. He is now running for governor and is also a member of the board of trustees of the university. A week after Buck Frick's carnival, Leaping Lena Lubell called a press conference in the Alumni Association office. He had not spoken out earlier, he told reporters, because he had been extending his own investigations on campus subverters. He said, "I am shocked, sad, and angry that I must report that there are at least 45 political undesirables on our university staff." Asked by reporters for names, he said, "It is not my wish to injure individuals who, in their naivety, may have been led astray by misplaced idealism and false propaganda. But as a loyal citizen, I cannot ignore the existence of these men in positions of responsibility. I expect that my efforts will be misinterpreted and distorted so as to hurt me politically. But in the present critical situation, I will not place personal interests before patriotic duty." The AC Herald headlined 45 in campus commentary. Similar banners appeared on every paper in the state. The next day's news was based on a no story, the refusal by Chancellor Dowson to talk to reporters or to issue a denial. There were editorials captioned, "How about it, Chancy?" and "Red virus or red blood?" On the third day, Chancellor Dowson wrote a confidential letter to Leaping Lena. On Monday, the Chancellor made his first public statement. The peace-loving Quaker, to whom newspaper brawling was alien, said, "I agree with Mr. Lubell that the administration of our university is best qualified to pass judgment on faculty loyalties, and I am glad to say that the administration knows of no teacher guilty of undermining our society or destroying our university. We cannot, of course, consider Mr. Lubell's suggestion to go to our faculty for information. I am sure Mr. Lubell will understand that teachers are not public masters, but public servants, that a university staff is not aspiring, that when citizens watch neighbors as enemies, democracy is in dissolution." The Chancellor's letter left Leaping Lena no alternative but to produce names. He telephoned Buck Frick, whom he'd never met. "For Christ's sakes," he says, "why ask me? I don't know any professor's names, red or white." Lena called Tom Prue. This is the university security officer. "Where am I going to get 45, asked Tom. "I don't even think I got 15. "Well, give me 10 to begin with, damn it," said Lena, "and keep a lookout for others." Prue dug into his file, beginning with a folder labeled Progressive Party. The men and women whose names he found there were departed, either from campus or from Earth, or they had gone into such respectable conservatism as to be useless. The same was true of the Roosevelt Truman folder. The Volunteers for Stevenson folder was only slightly more promising. Most of these were still around, but they were largely classics and English professors who admired the statesman's literacy rather than his politics. The foreign folder had possibilities. An Italian-born political science professor was on record as saying that an American-type capitalist democracy, successful in a land of limitless resources, was not especially adaptable to an overly populated, meagerly endowed land like Italy. Dr. Yossel Ehrenman not only recommended abolition of nuclear testing, he was, besides, a Russian. The Pole Oleg Koz was dead. Globalism turned up a journalism professor, Stephen Doyle, who during his newspaper career had favored foreign aid, and just a week ago had written a letter making fun of Leaping Lena's temple cleansing campaign. It also turned up Professor Christian Mauter. Race was disappointing. There was a coach who insisted on the right of a Negro athlete to participate in a track meet, and drama professor Sean Eaton was listed with a question mark because his wife was known to fraternize with Negroes. The name of Professor Mauter was in this folder also, followed by a question mark. The folder labeled perverts proved fruitless, since it was the university's practice to banish deviates as soon as they were discovered. Prue ended with a list of 11 names, against not one of which was the evidence more than circumstantial. The picture would have looked brighter, he reflected, if Coase had not taken things in his own hands and committed suicide. On his part, Leaping Lena turned in desperation to the legislative files on subversion. Here, a melange of clippings, transcribed phone conversations, and crank letters produced two Negro sympathizers, an economic professor who once lectured on the welfare state, and a sociologist registered as a political independent. From Senator Howard Spencer, Lena heard of a professor who, according to the senator's niece, assigned students to read the works of a pervert, Oscar Wilde, and a Russian. And a Russian, Dostoevsky. The fellow was from New York, Christian Mauter. When he compared his list with Tom Prue's, Lena found the name of Professor Mauter on both. We jump a bit here. Dean Sawyer, moderating the Academic Freedom Forum, took a surreptitious look at his watch and noted with relief it was after 9:30. The forum was nearly three quarters over. There would be time for only five more questions. The speaker, Dr. George Webson, was a middle-of-the-road economist who in 1952 had unsuccessfully defended the right of a biology professor to organize a campus Volunteers for Stevenson organization. A frail-looking elderly man with a halting voice, Dr. Webson was lamenting the absence of academic freedom in Russia, where, he said, Socrates, Copernicus, and Newton would not have been tolerated, and where both professors and scholars must falsify evidence. The dean had predicted that Wedgson and two other panelists had predicted what Wedgson and two other panelists would say. Dr. Cynthia Sutherland, professor of rhetoric, could be counted on to take the Tory position. She had once single-handedly forced the resignation of a young history professor because he carelessly suggested at a party that Lincoln, if he were alive today, would be a Democrat. She was a large, tweedy woman of 50 with short, curly gray hair and a wide, crusty face dusted over with white powder. Beside her, the third panelist, Indian agricultural student Ajurama Vananda, young, small, and dark, with blue-brown skin, black hair, and mustache, and darting eyes, was like a visitor from another planet. He had been chosen to supply the liberal position because, being both foreign and non-faculty, the university could not be held accountable for anything he might say. The unpredictable entity was Professor Mauter. When the dean saw the large crowd of townspeople who were ordinarily not interested in university affairs, he was apprehensive. He was even more disturbed when Mina Bruce pointed out to him that a delegation of veterans was in the rear of the hall. But Mauter's opening statement about a teacher's divided responsibilities to his student, to society, and to himself had been short, clear, and not inflammable. And now, as Wedgson's address came to a close, the dean told himself with an inner smile that everything was running as smoothly as an old-time Chautauqua. The dean would have preferred questions to be submitted beforehand, but the spontaneity of a New England town meeting was a forum tradition, so the best he could do was to try to pick questioners judiciously. Among the dozen hands that were waving for attention, he noted that of a history graduate fellow on whom he could rely. But before the dean could signal him to his feet, a student directly behind him had jumped up and was asking, "How can we speak of academic freedom when professors aren't allowed to take part in politics?" I'm sorry, said the dean. I was recognizing the gentleman in front of you. You've got a question, a voice shouted. The dean hammered for order, but still another voice called out, answer the question that's been asked. He decided to rely on Dr. Sutherland for a reply. The rhetoric professor began with a quotation from Frank Harris, a curious author for her to be reading, he thought. Nations like fish go rotten first in the head. The dean wondered if Dr. Sutherland, whose face had turned red even through its powder, had properly understood the question. Her public speeches were described in the press as silver scimitar. The dean's secret opinion was that it was really nothing except brass signifying nothing. Like a drunken spider, she wove her web of metaphors, saying, a teacher is a trustee of knowledge, a guardian of truth. He is no robed nihilist to lead young Americans away from the sun. She stopped for applause, and then she went on, saying, only by spiritually mobilizing against the infectious cankers will we hold the ramparts. The applause drowned out her voice, and now the dean was convinced of something he had tried to dismiss from his mind since the evening began, that the wild clapping and shouting and stomping which greeted Dr. Sutherland's remarks were a cover for the student's mockery. To save the meeting from becoming a shambles, he called on Ashramavananda. The Indian, his boyish thinness outlined in his brown silk suit, spoke precisely, saying, you will forgive me for confessing that I have observed a confusion of semantics. I hear men speak of freedom when what they really mean is the possession of private property. It is not dishonest to believe in possessions, but it is dishonest to call such a belief freedom and then condemn those who do not share it. To speak of academic freedom is to define for teachers the greatest of all of America's fine freedoms, which is the freedom of thought. The Indian was respectfully applauding. When he was done, he returned to his seat, and the dean called on Matt, who said we must be grateful to Mr. Fernanda for reminding us that we are speaking of a freedom guaranteed in our Constitution. He spoke slowly, deliberating each word, creating in spite of himself a kind of tension. I believe a teacher not only has the right to be interested in politics, but that he has not the right not to be interested. A teacher who does not participate in this daily and sometimes ruthless activity of man fails his students, just as he fails society. This time, the applause was more prolonged. As long as Malthus kept his comments abstract, the dean decided he would not worry. Hands waved, the student got to his feet and said, last night I listened to Prokofiev's classic symphony, and in the afternoon I read the Pisan cantos of Ezra Pound. Would the panel agree with certain critics of the university that in these acts I was committing treason? Like a jack-in-the-box, Dr. Sutherland was on her feet, demanding, why not cherish our own life-sustaining culture, the positive melodies of Stephen Collins Foster and South Pacific, the strengthening literature of Longfellow and Taylor Caldwell? The applause rose in the hall like a roaring sea. The students had at last succeeded in destroying the dignity of the forum with their raucous contempt. But Dr. Sutherland seemed only to hear the frenzied clapping, and in her triumph she ignored the dean's gestures that she sit down. Why doesn't the university offer courses in Soviet history, geography, and economics? A voice shouted out. The dean leaped to his feet, took Dr. Sutherland almost brutally by the arm, and pushed her back into her chair. Then he prodded Dr. Wedgson out of his seat and dragged him, dazed and confused, to the microphone. The old man began with a faltering voice to say, a university is a sensitive laboratory for the shaping of young minds. He waited and began again, seeking to be heard above the uproar, saying, naturally, in young minds, we all have a vital concern. The dean glanced in desperation at his watch. In the 3 minutes that remained, he must somehow restore order. A student's voice was shouting from the floor, why not teach disbelief in communism instead of prohibiting belief in it? The dean, a fixed smile on his face, turned despairingly toward Matt and opened his arms in a gesture of helplessness. Would you please take the question, Professor Mather, he said. I agree, Matt began, that we should fear our ignorance about alien political theories as much as we fear the states that embrace them. When we cut ourselves off from a knowledge of other men, then we endanger ourselves, and we endanger all humanity. I consider it one of my responsibilities as a teacher to present all views, and not only those of which I or my society may approve. A student was asking, would you permit a political discussion in your class if you knew you'd be criticized for it? Yes, said Matt. Do you think a communist should be permitted to teach? Probably not, if he slanders his instruction for the purpose of overthrowing our form of government, Matt said. If you were a university administrator, would you hire Picasso as a teacher? In his panic, the dean raised his gavel to declare the question irrelevant. But Matt was already speaking. I'm not a university administrator, and Picasso isn't likely to accept a teaching offer from an American university, Matt said. Then there was laughter in the room. But I just can't hear any universal official saying to Picasso, you cannot teach art at our university, or to Shaughnessy, you cannot teach literature, or to Shostakovich, we will not permit you to teach music. It was as far as he got. Dr. Salonen had sprung to her feet like a tiger, and her voice rose above the roar of applause. There are antidotes, she shouted. There are antidotes for the corrosive acids of socialism. A voice called, let him speak. Reloom freedom's torch, Dr. Sutherland shouted. This time the laughter was so strong that no amount of clapping could cover it. Dr. Sutherland's jaw kept moving and her arms gesticulated, but her words could not be heard. A group of students began to sing, Hail Chief Alacoma, and in the balcony others started on Fertile Myrtle. The dean beat on the lectern, announcing the meeting adjourned. But there was no need for the signal. People were leaving the auditorium, and on the stage, the slight form of Ashramavananda disappeared behind the curtain and escaped into the night. The following day, Leaping Lena was swept into the governorship by a 2-1 majority, and with him came 5 new university trustees. On that same Tuesday, the newspapers carried Chancellor Dowson's statement that the good names of innocent, dedicated men had been sacrificed to political ambition. But by Wednesday, it was apparent that the Lubell-Spencer faction would be in control of the university, and Chancellor Dowson resigned. On Thursday, in an emergency session, the trustees elected Provost Gerald Avery the new chancellor. And so the lunatic week rolled on. An unexpected beneficiary of the Holocaust was Dean Marcus Sawyer. 1 week after the election, he was chosen for provost. In announcing the appointment, the newspapers noted his scholarly studies of the life and work of George Meredith. The next day, the society columns announced that the new provost's marriage to Mina Bruce would take place in the chapel of the Holy Comforter at dusk of St. John's Eve on the 20th of June. In the morning, when Matt arrived in Sawyer's office at the appointed hour of 10, Tom Prue was already seated beside Sawyer's desk with a briefcase on the floor by his chair. His manner was hearty, and his brown suit was daringly complemented by a bright yellow shirt and a natty blue and red paisley bow tie. Behind the neatly cleared walnut-topped desk, Sawyer seemed dwarfed. His face was tense, and he was nervously tapping the rubber end of a pencil against the chromium base of a lamp. The third man in the room was a court stenotypist, thin, with faded hair, and wearing a gray pinstripe suit. The typist bent over his machine, himself scarcely more than a machine, committed to the role of grim recorder of these mistakes of men. We want you to know how grateful we are to you for coming, said Sawyer, getting to his feet. His summer-weight blue flannel suit and sober tie lent a disturbingly church-like air to the occasion. Matt wondered, in ironic humor, if his heather tweed jacket and gray flannel slacks were appropriate. He listened to Sawyer's earnest voice saying, we're all of us distressed when harmful rumors are circulated. No one wants to lend dignity to gossip. No one expects you to answer any of the... The voice trailed into silence, and again Sawyer laid his hand on the back of the green-leather chair that faced Tom Prue. Sit down, won't you, Mather, he said. When Matt was seated, Sawyer continued. We all felt that a friendly investigation of the irresponsible allegations would serve a better purpose. Better, that is to say, than any public denial you might... He seemed to be lost in words. Since Tom here has made a very thorough study of the voice faltered, and Sawyer ran one finger inside the collar of his shirt, so we felt the best way. The words came as if squeezed from the increasing tightness of his throat. We thought the best way, that is, if you and he, well, you know, you could sort of pick each other's brains, or rather, if you picked at each other's, he gave a laugh and rang a key too high. That might be more accurate, picked at, eh, he said. He was bending over Matt, laughing, his face too close, his hand on Matt's shoulder like that of a friend. Prue removed his coat and hung it on the back of his chair, saying, "Might as well be comfortable. Anybody join me, Professor?" "I'm more at ease with mine on," said Matt. His jacket seemed to him a suit of armor that would conceal the dark, angry stirring in his blood. The stenotypist, as if declaring on which side he stood, got to his feet and removed his jacket. "Cigarette, Professor?" Prue said. "No? Well, you'll live longer," he said, when Matt refused, with a gesture of his hand. He faced Matt over his open briefcase. Cancer, heart, diabetes, they're blowing everything on tobacco now. You begin coughing, get a raw throat, can't breathe right, then wham, you find out one day it's too late. You wonder how a self-respecting fellow can do it to himself. "I wish I had your strength of character. Different people smoke different things. Chinamen smoke opium, Indians smoke hemp." His eyes had been studying the window, and now he brought them quickly back to Matt's face. "Marijuana, we call it. Ever try it?" he asked. "No, I haven't," said Matt. "Professor, you like people to be candid, don't you?" Prue said. "Well, I'm a candid fellow. I'll show you how candid I am. I'll ask right out, if your intellectual curiosity that we've been heard so much about here, if it ever included the needle." Sawyer was leaning forward on his desk, his lips moving, but his vocal cords made no sound. When the words finally came, the sound was hoarse and dry. "Tom, I was under the impression that I thought this interrogation would pursue academic..." "The needle," Matt said. He looked at Prue, and then at the stenotypist, tapping silently, swiftly, at his keys, and he knew that even if this were ever erased from his mind, it still would be on record, irrevocable as history. "Yeah, jab, jab. You know, narcotics," Prue said. "What I'm getting at is that boy Collins, the one you've been such a good friend to, he used to get pretty hopped up in your house, I've been told." "I knew that Collins used narcotics. That's why I got him into a hospital," Matt said. Sawyer, still leaning forward, once more began speaking with difficulty, saying, "I don't think it's necessary to go into the Collins affair again. We all know about Professor Mather's rehabilitation of the student." "Yes, admirable," said Prue, addressing the window. "Don't let me upset you, Professor. I'm really a good fellow, a friendly guy. I don't mean any harm." "We're on your side, Mather," said Sawyer. "I think that goes without saying. I think you know that." "Maybe you'd like to take your coat off now," said Prue. "Maybe some fresh air. Might I open the window?" He got up and opened it. "I don't know about you fellows, but I never think clearly in a stuffy room." He returned to the chair. "Yes, that was a fine thing, getting that boy off the hook, making a fine, useful citizen out of him." The voice was as bland as milk. "Still see him, do you?" "He's still my student." "Naturally, you want to keep an eye on to see he doesn't backslide." "I don't think he will. You know, you've got to have confidence in a fellow to loan him your car." "Vance Collins has used my car twice, I think it was," Matt said. "Why shouldn't he? He has a license. My insurance is in order." Prue shrugged. "Still, you take a chance. A fellow like that driving a car. Say he decided to go back on the needle. He could be a very serious nuisance on the road. I don't want to sound ornery, but these are things you have to think of. Like, what does he do in the car?" For a moment, Prue looked toward the window as if lost in thought. And then he said, "Maybe girls. Unless, of course, the boy isn't interested in girls, then we got an entirely different problem. A fellow who's on the needle, how can you tell he hasn't got this curiosity about other abnormal experiences?" Again, the provost sought to speak. And again, his voice failed him. "We have a copy of the boy's psychiatric prognosis on file," the provost managed to say at last. "It makes no mention of any abnormal tendencies." "You got some students think very highly of you, Professor," Prue went on. "I tell you, I'd be proud. I don't know how many professors got such low students like, well, like this Narcotte, for instance." He'd taken a paper from his briefcase and was studying it for a moment. "You don't often hear a student say he loves a professor. Then there's Carla Maddock. That girl's really on your side. Anyone listening to her might think she's carrying a torch. And Captain Turner, he couldn't speak more highly of you. Says you're a regular fellow. A real man's man you can respect. Someone to go fishing with and hunting. Never knew a professor take such an interest in his students," says Turner. "Like when you went to his room one Sunday morning, even before he was up, to talk over some things." Prue's voice trailed off, and his eyes focused on the trees outdoors. Then suddenly he turned on Matt and said, "What about your wife, Professor? Where's she at?" The question was like a thrust in the wound. My wife and I have been divorced, he said. Before Prue could pursue it further, Sawyer cut in, his voice suddenly sharp. It was my understanding that we will be discussing teaching problems. I don't see how Professor's personal affairs can be of interest to us. His voice rose in anger, crying out, "We must not forget that Professor Mather is distinguished both as an author and a teacher, that he came voluntarily to make a contribution to our university, and that we are greatly in his debt. His humiliations do not diminish him. It diminishes us." Matt listened to the sincere fervor of his words, and in that moment he knew that everything, intellectual, academic, courage, all were powerless before the evil of the others. He smiled across the desk at Sawyer, loving him in that instant in which he knew Sawyer's defense of him would be of absolutely no avail. "Okay, you want to pursue academic lines," Prue was saying. "The picture I get, Professor, is you have some very original ideas, like the one that Jesus was a communist. Naturally, it's very upsetting to students hearing things like that." I think the discussion was of the common root of the words communion and communism. And the point was made that Jesus was concerned with the community of brotherhood, Matt said. "Words, Professor, words, words, words. We got God-fearing citizens who'd rather see their children dead than have them hear being told things like that. You can't play people wondering when their sons and daughters hear that Jesus is a communalist and that Karl Marx is the most important man of our century." What I said was that Marx and Darwin were the two 19th century thinkers who most had molded our own century, Matt said. He was, in spite of all logic, suddenly filled with a sort of confidence. "Students can't help wondering, Professor," said Prue, his voice perplexed, "when you read to them from Karl Marx how they should overthrow the government." Prue reached behind Sawyer's desk and drew out a gray fiber case, which he laid on the desk and carefully opened. Inside was a tape recorder. In front of Matt's eyes, there passed the tormented face of Olive Cove, and he knew that Cause's nightmare had now become his own. He remembered Freud had written that the paranoid is usually right. Prue snapped a button, and after some crackling noises, Matt heard his own voice reading, "Whenever any form of government becomes destructive, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness." Prue clicked off the machine. "Would you like to hear it again, Professor?" he asked quietly. "Don't bother," Sawyer cried out. "Those words on your tape, Tom, weren't written by Karl Marx. They're Thomas Jefferson's. If you want to read them in context, Prue, you'll find them in the Declaration of Independence." Matt looked at the two men beyond the desk, at Prue's face, pale with confusion, at Sawyer's gray and drawn, as a tombstone's death's head, and suddenly he began to laugh. A few days later, Matt receives a telegram informing of the death of his father in New Hampshire. Matt put down the phone. "Carla," he whispered in the silence of the room. "Carla, sweet, lovely, understanding Carla." He set off in search of her, and not finding her in the green-shuttered white house where she lived, he drove to Music Hall. He walked up the steps to the doors, standing open, and passed under the frieze of lutes, pipes, and music rolls carved in the stone. And as if he had called her name, Carla appeared in the sunlit hall. "My last examination's over," she said, exulting. Matt took her books, and they walked together down the steps into the afternoon. 2 hours of opera history. "What is the premise of the magic flute?" "It's love, perfect love, simply that," he said. "Is it that one must grow up, become mature, not just in years, but in experience too, before love is possible?" She spoke quickly, in excitement and relief. "I guess I did all right." He walked close to her, seeing below his shoulder the side of her face, the left side even more beautiful than the right, he thought, looking at the curve of the cheek, corner of his mouth. "Will you fly with me to New Hampshire?" he asked in sudden elation. He felt as if a weight he had been bearing was lifted from his heart. "Will you be my maturity? Will you be my experience? May I love you perfectly, forever?" She stopped still on the short, bright grass, and she looked at him, and she said, "I'll go anywhere you say." "Do you know the right side of your face more beautiful than the left?" Or is it the left? Let me see. And then, as she laughed, he remembered, in self-rebuke, the reason he had sought her out. "I've had very serious news," he said. "My father is dead." The people who filled the New Hampshire church for Isaac's funeral were nearly all strangers to Matt. The minister's wife played "Come Sweet Death" and "Sleepers Awake." And the Reverend Trout, an earnest young man with black hair and eyes, spoke on a text from the Psalms. "Thy seed will I establish forever and build up a throne to all generations." I think I'll leave this funeral scene off because the time is short. There is a long description of the funeral here in which he recalls all his ancestors, including one he's in a family plot with all the tombstones, and he reads during the burial service of his father the tombstone, the carvings, and there is one, Corporal Perseverance Mother, died for truth, 1776, of a wound in his belly. And that's the last thing. The day after the funeral, he and Carla drove in the minister's car to the Athens County Courthouse for a marriage license. They planned to be married quietly by the Reverend Trout when the required waiting days had passed. When they returned, they were interrupted by the young minister, dressed in khaki trousers and a white t-shirt, bringing them two letters from Alacoma, which had just arrived in the mail. They sat on the grass in the sun to read them. The first one Matt opened bore the letterhead of the university. It was brief, typewritten, and signed by the provost. "My dear Professor Mother, I've been advised by Dr. Robert, who attended you in your illness, that you've decided not to return to us this autumn. Naturally, I will not announce this until I've had confirmation directly from you. I think you know how sorry we shall be to lose you, but at the same time, we must not accept any decision which might not ensure your improved health. If you would be as good as to write me that your doctors have advised against continuing your duties here, I shall then take the proper action. With all personal good wishes, sincerely yours, Marcus Sawyer." Matt read the letter through twice, and he handed it to Carlo. "Is this my past, or my future, or my present?" he said, feeling the old anxieties, the indecisions, assailing him again. The second letter, also typewritten, covered two pages. It bore the signatures of Ken Narcott and Vance Collins, and it said, "Dear Christian, we've never called you by your name before, and we have never heard you called by this name. Yet it is yours, and you are worthy of it more than anyone we know. You have gone away from us, and the rumor is that you will not return. We should like to say, come back. We need you. But we have no right to say this. So we will say instead, never give up your teaching. For the voices we have been hearing all our lives are the voices of concealers and evaders. Or else we hear no voices, when those we ask questions turn away in silence. When teachers remain silent, they are lying just as much as they spoke their lies out loud. And as long as they lie, either by false words or by silence, then we, the students, must turn away from them. But suddenly, there was you. Because of the things you said quietly in class, and because of the things you did, we were not abandoned anymore. Our ears hear now, thanks to you, our eyes see, our hearts beat. You have turned us into learners, which we will remain as long as we live. We know when the university betrayed you that we, your students, also betrayed you. When we read our words, so misused by Prue in the press, and when we read your words, so misused by Prue in the press, and would not speak out, we were concealers and evaders, no less than those whom we hold in contempt. But in the moment that we failed you, our real liberation began. Once Ehrenman said that when a teacher despairs, he sins against men. For it is the teacher who must see that men hold to their visions and to reverence for humanity. You have done this for us. We know one fact. Whoever is seeking a teacher is really seeking himself. In finding you, we have begun to find ourselves. We believe no one will ever again be able to instill in us a fear of consequences. Even though we have not the right, we shall say it now. We want you to come back to us." Last paragraph of the book. "Carla," Matt said, "I'm going to wire Sawyer." Yes, said Carla, swimming beside him, the water making seaweed of her hair. I know it can't be any other way. In the cemetery on Perseverance Martyr's tombstone, it's written that he died for truth in the War of Liberation, Matt said. He turned on his back and floated on the cold breast of the lake. Do you remember that? So you see, my dear, the choice was never really mine to make, he said. And he knew then that things were clearer than they ever had been before in his life. The choice was made by Perseverance 200 years ago, he said.